one of my DJs was DJing on a Disney Carnival cruise, and he was coming back to California, but the ship docked in Orlando and he had to get a flight back to California. And so I was like, well, why don't I just have a show in Florida? So, you know, at the time I have no money. I'm just like pinching pennies. I was like, well, if I can save on a round trip flight for him from LA to Orlando, because he's already going to be in Orlando, I only have to buy a flight for me to come down there and I'll get his return flight to Orlando. And we sold 1,000 tickets on our first show in Orlando just through Facebook marketing, like Facebook and Instagram ads. And I've never been to Orlando before, ever in my life, except as a kid for like Disney World, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't know anybody in Orlando. This was just crazy to me. Like selling 1,000 tickets in a place I had never been before was just like incredible. And it was that moment when I truly knew, you know, oh wow, I have something that people are interested in, and the power of digital advertising can really help scale this thing. And then, so it was like 4 cities 3 years ago. And I mean, now we've played in over like 45 cities.
Hello, and welcome to How Things Grow. How Things Grow tells the stories of the people who help companies, technologies, and economic systems take off. Each episode features an interview with one of the leading growth practitioners, entrepreneurs, or experts in the world today. We dive into the stories of these folks. We talk about origins, early victories, strokes of luck, troughs of failure, and much, much more to deconstruct many of the things they do to drive dramatic growth for their companies and technologies. How Things Grow is presented by me, Shamant Rao, the CEO of the mobile user acquisition firm Rocketship HQ. My guest today is Jabari Johnson, the founder of Colors Worldwide, a live events company that produces parties and music events across 45 cities in the United States. This is a fascinating conversation, both for Jabari's personal story as well as for his insights on scaling what would appear to be a high-touch event, how he's thought about aspects such as marketing, pricing, and filling up rooms and halls at scale is truly fascinating. Jabari's story from his earliest days when he hustled to interview stars like Nicki Minaj and Justin Bieber before they became famous, about how he basically landed a job on the strength of his YouTube channel, and of course to more recent days when he thoughtfully considers marketing, pricing, and market research decisions for Colors and R&B Only. All of these provide a very fascinating window into how it's absolutely possible to run top-notch events, make them fun, and do that at scale. I'm very excited to welcome Jabari Johnson to How Things Grow. Jabari, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You have such a fascinating story, and I'm also particularly fascinated because you are in a world that's so different from the one I'm in and that a lot of our listeners are in. So I am hoping that when you tell the story of how you started and launched a live events business that a lot of people would consider high touch and grown it so dramatically, and I would imagine we will all have a lot to learn from you. Before you started your business that you're running right now, you were making YouTube videos. What inspired you to do this? How did you pick the folks that you interviewed, included Nicki Minaj, Justin Bieber? So tell us about this phase of your life.
I've just been a music fan for so long. And when I was interviewing artists, I wanted to have like one of their early meaningful interviews before they were like household names, before everybody knew them. And so that was really it. I was just interviewing people that I was fans of and trying to find any way that I could get some sort of access to them. I had a little show on YouTube. It was through another website called hiphopgame.com. And I don't even think it exists anymore. But I got them to let me put the videos on my YouTube channel so I could grow that YouTube channel, but I was embedded on their website. That's really how I started in like seriously in entertainment.
Yeah. And you said you wanted to catch a lot of these artists before they became famous. And in the videos that I saw on YouTube right now, say Jabari interviews Nicki Minaj before she was famous. Jabari interviews Justin Bieber before he was famous.
Let me tell you about that. Even that though was like a growth hack thing, right? Because those videos weren't initially titled that. Like I changed the titles of those videos years after those people were huge, you know, because I knew that that's the type of query that people would have online. They wanted to see people before they were famous, so I changed the title.
Interesting. That was to get more juice out of the search engines. You know, I watched those videos and they look so candid and unscripted. Bieber looks like a baby. So when you were picking these people to interview, what about them gave you the idea that these guys could become big someday, if at all, anything, right? Or you were like, let me just interview cool people? Or what was it like?
Yeah, I mean, I knew that these people were going to be somewhat big because I was a fan of the music. I mean, that's ultimately everything that I get involved in, I'm typically a fan of. I was watching the moves that Nicki Minaj was making in like the mixtape world. So before, like in hip hop, before you put out an album, technically, well, in the past, you're supposed to like put out some mixtapes. I mean, it's a free project, you know, that people can just easily download. This is way before like the streaming era. And she was putting out that kind of music that was touching a lot of people, and a lot of people were watching her YouTube videos. And I remember the first time I ever reached out to her was on MySpace. And I just was a fan early on. I didn't know she was going to be like the biggest female rapper of all time. Yeah. I didn't think that necessarily, but I did think she was going to be like a big artist. And then Justin, same kind of story. He only had one real song out at the time. It was called One Time. That was before his big smash hit called Baby. But I would just watch his YouTube videos. I was a big fan of him on YouTube. And a buddy of mine, which is now one of the biggest moguls in music, his name is Scooter Braun. He used to manage another rapper named Asher Roth, who had a song called I Love College. And so I interviewed a rapper that he was managing. And then he said, hey, I got this kid who's a singer too, but he really likes hip hop. I want you to be the first person in like the hip hop world to interview him. And that's how that started. So it just really ultimately starts from being a fan and just having a good ear and good eye for like the potential of people.
Cool. That's crazy, but also makes sense because you were following what seemed cool to you, what seemed interesting to you, and you had good taste. And that's what resulted in these very unprecedented videos.
Right. Yeah. I interviewed a ton of people that are not famous.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So, it's just, you know, I think it was a numbers thing as well. You know, I probably did 100 interviews in 2 years. So
certainly.
A few of them are bound to blow up.
Exactly. And of course, part of what you were doing then was being a very early adopter on YouTube. And you've spoken about why this is so important to you and your career and everything you've done since then. Now, what would you attribute your interest in being an early adopter to?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think that ultimately, I'm always looking for the opportunities. I wouldn't even just say in music, but I mean, really in entertainment. I think tech and entertainment are like closely aligned, but a lot of times like people in music tend to be late adopters. Right, the people that adopt things early are typically the artists, but the people behind the scenes of the music, whether it's like people creating content or whether it's executives or marketing directors or these type of things, those people don't understand. I just think that the music industry is so cyclical and it's very, for lack of better words, like monkey see, monkey do. Like a lot of people are like, I see this person doing this, it's working, let's go and make 1,000 other people do this until we've dried that well out so much. And I think that I was always trying to look for something new to do within music and entertainment. And at the time, I saw there wasn't a lot of people making long form content on YouTube. This is like maybe 8 years ago, 9 years ago. What is it, 2019? Yeah, this is around like 2009, 10, 11. And yeah, there just wasn't a lot of people doing like music documentaries on YouTube, but there was a lot of short form stuff on YouTube. And I just wanted to get into creating longer form content because I felt like this was a medium that people were going to use in a far different way than they were using at the time. Now, looking back, I think some of my stuff was a bit premature and like early, especially some of my longer form content, but it all helped me get to, you know, where I'm at today. But ultimately, I've just tried to do things in a unique and different way than a lot of people were in the entertainment industry.
Indeed. And certainly you've spoken about how a lot of your YouTube videos helped you almost find your voice in a certain way and, you know, create a body of work that informed a lot of the work you did later on. Of course, the first way in which that manifested was really how your YouTube videos helped start off your career and get you your first jobs. And can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've had a lot of jobs in my life, but post-college, my first real job in the entertainment industry was working for Capitol Records. My job hadn't been, at that time, this is in 2010, there was nobody with my job before. So they just stuck it under the umbrella of social media coordinator. But really what I did was I created a lot of video and all kinds of digital video campaigns and projects for a lot of the artists that were working at the label. And the only reason I got that job, literally, I mean, I had a resume and stuff, but I went into the office and I just pulled up my YouTube channel and they pretty much, like, I went back on the train to go home and they were hiring me. Yeah. And they said, you can do half of the things that you've done on your YouTube channel for us or our artists. We love that. So my job wasn't really about social media. It was about content creation. And that was the first time that I saw that the things that I was doing on my own could lead me to something a bit more stable. But then shortly after that, I realized I'd rather just be doing things on my own than for like another company.
Yeah, that's so interesting. In fact, multiple people on this podcast have alluded to how producing good work is oftentimes the best resume.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. And it's hard to turn down somebody that's done cool, interesting work. Especially when you are at a very nascent stage of an industry, because 2010, there were like no social media coordinators. So there's like no social media department at the time, right? So
there was absolutely no social media department. Social media was also an afterthought, YouTube channels and that type of thing. It was very much an app. Anybody had a record label at that time. Now, that's all music marketing is. I mean, there is no real focus on anything else, but you know, maybe terrestrial radio, but yeah, it's pretty much all digital and social.
Yeah. And when you were making YouTube videos, either for yourself or at the jobs you were at, how did you think about spreading the word about these videos, interviewing all these artists?
Yeah. So funny story. I mean, initially when I was in college making these videos, this is when Facebook was super early on. I was in college from 2005 to 2009. And what I would do is I went to the library and I was like, okay, I have about 2,000 friends on Facebook. So how can I get all these people to like watch my videos? Because this was at a time when, I mean, this was pre-YouTube algorithms and all that stuff. And like, you really had to spread your videos out. I would get a list of my Facebook friends. I go to the library, print out all of my Facebook friends so I could easily have them as a stack of paper. And I would flip through about 50 sheets and I would just, you could only send like 25 people a message at once before Facebook like stopped you. And so I would just look up one page, like a book almost, and just flip the page. And I would say like, hey, I just made this video with Nicki Minaj. I want you to check it out. Let me know what you think. And I would sit in the library for hours and just every time I dropped a video, I would send the YouTube link out like that. And what started happening was my videos would kind of gain like this like local virality throughout like my college. And then I kind of became like a little mini celebrity in college because people would be like, oh, that's the guy that interviewed Justin Bieber. And he's like in my class. And so that's really how I started getting the word out about the videos in the early days. And I don't even know this was called like growth hacking at the time, where I was trying to do things with growth in mind. But I would purposely interview people that would have like a bit of a following of some sort. And you know, because I would want people that saw that interview to become fans of my interviews. So I would like Google Nicki Minaj and go like maybe 10, 12 pages back in like the Google search results. And every blog, at the time, blogs were really big. So every blog that had posted about her, I would find the contact info for like the editors and writers of that blog. And then I would individually send them messages saying, hey, if you like that song she put out, here's an interview where she's talking about, you know, something related to that. And that's how I got the word out, was really just through people that I knew, and then cold emails to people that were interested in the artist, without writing about the artist that I was interviewing.
That's intense hustling right there. And it takes grunt work and hustle to get word out. Sometimes you just realize it's about getting yourself out there, talking to a lot of people. And like you said, you were so ubiquitous, it sounds like, that everybody knew you're the guy making these videos.
Right? And so because what ends up happening is you want to get to a point of being top of mind for whatever it is that you're doing. Yes. You know what I mean? So at that time, a decade ago, I was top of mind for like these hip hop interviews with people that were on the cusp of blowing up. It was like, you know, that if you're looking for something in that niche, Jabari is the guy. And now with any sort of event series or thing that I put out, we try to be top of mind within that niche of whatever it is that we're doing.
Right.
And the only way to really get there is to continuously do it. Like, it's entertainment, especially live entertainment now, it's a game of like, what have you done for me lately? People don't really care about what you did 6 months ago. Yeah. Like, what is on the calendar going forward?
Yeah, and interesting how you mentioned that you wanted to stay top of mind as the guy who profiles artists who are about to blow up. This reminds me of the book, I believe it's called The 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing. I think it's in the 70s or something. And they talk about how a lot of brands can be a category of one. You cannot be the first beer, but you can be the first craft beer. You can't be the first airline. You can be the first low-cost airline. And they give a bunch of examples. And, you know, what you're saying very, very much resonates with what they've said. And
you have to get that book and then send it to me, please.
Like, absolutely. Whatever. Post the link in the show notes for those of our listeners who may be interested to check this out. Let's switch gears a bit. So here you were making YouTube videos, being a social media person before that was a thing, right? You did that for a couple of years. What led to the origin of Colors?
So being on the road with so many different artists. When I was at Capitol Records, I was also like doing my own thing and making content and shooting videos on a bunch of different artists. And it was just something I was really passionate about, that I was doing it for a label and also doing it for myself. Being a freelancer and like making content for different media outlets and all that stuff. So I found myself in the midst of about 2 years, from about like 2010 to 2012, 2013, just making a ton of content and being on the road and at different shows with so many artists. And when I was doing that, I realized that these artists are making some money from, you know, like selling their music, but really where the bulk of their money comes from is like touring and the live event space. I didn't really know much about it, but I was working with the artist named Macklemore, right? Huge pop star now, but at the time, he was just a small little local rapper from Seattle. And I would go to his shows in various places, and I would see crowds of like 2, 3, 4, 5,000. And I was like, whoa, this is, this is pretty serious. So I wanted to get in that world, but I didn't quite have, I'm not a rapper, I'm not a singer, I'm not a musician. But I had to figure out how to get in that space. And it really started from just doing parties, small parties that were, I wanted to have unique experiences. I wanted to bring people together and make it not just about partying, but make it about community and having a good time. And I started a small party with a buddy of mine in New York called Surprise Party. And that eventually, you know, we both kind of wanted to do different things. We didn't really see eye to eye. Sometimes businesses don't work out with founders. And then that led to me starting my own sort of party series that was a little bit different called Colors. And that's how I got into the live space. It was really just inspiration from artists selling a bunch of tickets. And I figured I wanted to do something on my own, make it more DJ focused. And then the parties sort of transitioned into more like actual shows. And I knew that I couldn't just like make a living throwing parties because those would get old. So I had to sort of like make seriously branded shows and concepts.
Yeah. Do you remember what the first party was like?
Oh yeah, for sure. There are many firsts because I had done like some parties while I was in college where I just got some of my friends together. And that was truly the first. And then some of those early days in New York and in DC and LA, those were 200-300 people in a room, quite sweaty. At times it would be people who like didn't know us. They just allowed us to do events in there. We kind of, you know, some of the deals that we did were like really bad and pretty much like the venue made all the money. We didn't make any money. But yeah, it was just a lot of high energy and a lot of people that were interested in coming because the whole kind of niche was that there was like no VIP section. So everybody felt like they were a part of something, like they were in a community together. And this is at a time when in New York, clubs were becoming really VIP focused and centered. And it was about, it was about exclusivity more than inclusivity. And our parties at the time were far more about inclusivity.
In those early parties, how do you fill up a room with 200 to 300 people?
Well, the first one, man, I'm aging myself right now, but back in the day when Twitter was first around, so you couldn't upload pictures on Twitter originally. And you would have to use like a third party type of service. And at the time it was called TwitPic. It was basically a service that would give you a link and that it was just an easy way to show a picture, almost like a YouTube, but yeah, just for pictures. But the cool thing is TwitPic would show you how many views were on that picture. So we just put a flyer up and we got all of our friends. We were super intentional about not having people post this image on TwitPic, like on their own TwitPic, but we wanted everybody to post it, this TwitPic link from this one account that it was on. So the views would go up. And it was probably at about 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 views on this one image. And so that was the way that we had no like real RSVP system or whatever. We just had all the information on the TwitPic artwork. And we said, wow, 5,000 people have viewed this. So maybe that means like 5% of these people are going to show up, maybe 10%. And we had about, you know, 200 people or something like that. I don't know if that math works.
Yeah. No, but I know what you mean. So it sounds like you were very intentional, not just in using a lot of these new platforms, because Twitter was relatively new at the time. You were like very intentional and imaginative about using it to get what you wanted out of it, right? So I think that's very cool and very interesting. For these parties, you were seeing the YouTubers sort of have a lot of big live events, and you said that inspired you to host these parties. But also, like you said, there's like a ton of parties in New York, there's a ton of parties in LA. How did you think about distinguishing or differentiating what you were putting together compared to everything that is out there, which presumably were around for far, far longer?
Yeah, absolutely. I think especially like when I transitioned into Colors, the biggest thing for me was I knew initially, because I didn't have like, I was just starting a brand new business. I didn't have real track record for people with this brand. And so I just really focused it around having a good time, there not being a VIP section. This thing is about sort of like community. And I think the key element that differentiated me at the time was that a lot of my early events were RSVP. So I wasn't trying to necessarily make money from people. I was trying to get people to allow me to communicate with them so I could tell them about my future events. I still to this day encourage a lot of event producers that are just starting off to do this and to not charge money for tickets unless you have some really big draw that you think is going to make people pay. But you got to understand that you're competing with people scrolling on a feed, and when they see your thing pop up and you're going to now ask them for money, it's already hard enough to get people to like buy a digital product or buy a physical product and get their credit card out and stuff like that. But with an event, what's even harder is like you have to get somebody to like buy something online. That's the first step. But then you have to get them to come out of their house and leave the comforts of whatever they're doing to like experience what you are providing. And so it's like double conversion. And I knew that that was going to be a bit difficult. So my first event, I was just saying, hey, just RSVP, get there before a certain time. And if you do that, it's free.
Oh. And how did you think about actually making money then if a lot of the people would be free at the time?
Great question. One thing that happens in the event business, and people don't like to commit to things early. Some people do. So like there's a small percentage of people that do. But a lot of times what you'll find is that when you get to the day of the event or the last 48 hours of the event, it's like a bell curve where like it's just whenever something first goes on sale, and then it kind of dips down, and then there's a huge interest, right when something is about to happen. And so I knew that if I got a bunch of RSVPs in the beginning, that spreads the word of mouth and the virality about the event out.
Yeah.
And if I close the RSVP, a few days before the event, and now only people can buy tickets and the RSVP is expired, there's going to be a large amount of people that have purchased, because now you've hit sort of like this critical mass where there's a lot of people that are just interested in speaking about it. But then those other people that are hearing about it from word of mouth, they just have RSVP because it's too late and they'll pay.
That is very smart. So there's almost a social pressure on those that didn't make it actually buy at the last moment. Right. Is that the model you still follow, or is it like fully paid right now?
It's fully paid right now. It's just the way the business has scaled. And every once in a blue moon, we might do a free RSVP, show or something like that. But it really just depends on the market, and it depends on if we're trying to like highly increase our audience for a certain type of other thing that we're doing. But for the most part, pretty much. Still the same kind of model, though, where you're rewarding people with cheaper tickets that commit early.
So you were hosting these parties. At what point were you like, oh, this could actually become huge? We could just take it across multiple double-digit numbers of cities. What point did that potential become evident to you?
I think that happened at the moment where I transitioned from doing parties to shows. At the end of the hip hop parties called Colors, we used to play these R&B sets. So like we would slow the music down and we would play like more R&B records. And that's like far different than a high energy hip hop set where people are just raging and jumping up and down and partying. And I asked the crowd, I said, hey, if I did an event that was all R&B, would you guys come? It was sort of like my research, like when you go out and do market research, it was just like me doing that from a stage on a microphone to a bunch of crowd, to a huge crowd. And everybody started screaming and saying, yeah, we'd love that. Definitely do it. And so that was as much data as I needed at the time. And I just said, hey, let's do it. And we did it. And the first one was just crazy. I think as many people came, I think it was about 500 to 600 people that came for the first one. And then I did it again. It was like maybe a few months later, and then that jumped from like 600 to like 1,000. I had never had these numbers ever. There's a new concept called R&B only. And I wanted to make it more than just a party. So I had different sets and I had different DJs at the time, and I just tried to increase the production and stuff, putting in a little bit more music-centered venues instead of just like a bar or venues with larger stages. And I just started to see the numbers go up, up and up. And then I realized when I brought it to DC, LA, those are all places that, it was only in three cities at first. It was DC, LA, and New York. And I had previously done events in those cities. So one of the reasons that I knew that it could be big was that the crowds were far bigger at these shows than any of the original, like, Colors events. But the real way that I knew that this was going to be something that could scale nationally and even globally was when I brought it to Orlando, Florida, which is just a very random situation. This was about 3 years ago. One of my DJs was DJing on a Disney Carnival cruise, and he was coming back to California, but the ship docked in Orlando, and he had to get a flight back to California. And so I was like, well, why don't I just have a show in Florida? So, you know, at the time, I have no money. I'm just like pinching pennies. I was like, well, if I can save on a round trip flight for him from LA to Orlando, because he's already going to be in Orlando, I only have to buy a flight for me to come down there, and I'll get his return flight to Orlando. And we sold 1,000 tickets on our first show in Orlando just through Facebook marketing, like Facebook and Instagram ads. And I've never been to Orlando before, ever in my life, except as a kid for like Disney World, you know?
Yeah.
And like, I didn't know anybody in Orlando. This was just crazy to me. Selling 1,000 tickets in a place I had never been before was just like incredible. And it was that moment when I truly knew, you know, oh wow, I have something that people are interested in, and the power of digital advertising can really help scale this thing. And then, so it was like four cities 3 years ago. And I mean, now we've played in over like 45 cities.
Yeah. Sometimes that can feel magical when you go to a place that you would think really into music or isn't really something that, some place that you have an audience and it just blows up. That can feel
completely. Yeah, for sure. And it came full circle because recently we just had our first music festival like about 3 weeks ago in Orlando. And that was cool. I mean, it was, you know, a bunch of artists performed and, you know, seeing that it started from this little small thing to like this sort of huge, massive thing has been crazy.
Yeah. So I imagine in the beginning, you were attending a lot of these events yourself. You were organizing a lot of these events yourself.
Yeah.
And now you're like in 45 cities. Has there been a point when you're like, you know what? I'm not going to go to like all of these events. I can't because it's humanely extremely challenging. I'm sure you could do 45 events in a year, but it's still a lot of traveling. So how do you think about actually not doing it, a lot of the events all by yourself as your company's grown?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. Last year was our kind of biggest year where we just like scaled tremendously. We did 67 shows last year, and I was at every single one of those except for, we did three simultaneously on New Year's Eve. New Year's Eve is just a huge day for us. Number one, people really want to listen to R&B music on New Year's Eve. Number two, people just like going out on New Year's Eve. So R&B only is just massive on that day. And so we knew that we had to replicate me because the thing is, I'm the founder of the company and I'm like very much behind the scenes and running a staff of a lot of people. But at the same time, I actually do host the show and performing on stage with my DJ. And so there is this like conundrum of, being able, you want to scale the business, but I'm only human and you can only do so much touring. And so now, luckily, we have more hosts, more DJs on the team amidst like the other employees that we have. And they're going through this training and they're really hitting the ground running. And they've been with us for about a year now. I was just at a show in Charlotte, North Carolina that we sold out. About 2,000 people, roughly 2,000, like about 1,800. And that was the new team doing that show. So I was just there for kind of moral support. Even today, a lot of our staff have to leave LA today to go to a show in Raleigh. And yeah, that's them doing that. So I'll pretty much be just here stuck in the office by myself. And yeah, they're handling that. It was a lot of work though to try to get people. We had to have auditions and that type of thing because you're trying to bring people on that have the same essence as what you've created. And there's no way that it's going to be the exact same because this is like entertainment. What we're doing is unique. The people on stage are very unique to, and they make the show their own a bit. But there's guidelines and there's rules that we follow and there's sets that we have that, and there's certain songs that need to be played and there's certain cues and points that the DJs and hosts need to hit. The biggest thing is, this is like a restaurant. You don't want, when you go to an R&B only show with Jabari and Dashe, to feel different than when you go to an R&B only show with Tierra, Monique, or whoever else that we bring on to scale the business. But it's definitely a work in progress and something that we've been doing over this past year. I'm so happy that we started that because there's just no way I can run the business as well as do like 60, 70 shows a year. It's just too much.
Yeah, and I think what can be challenging is to maintain your essence, like you said, that Jabari can't stay, but really the essence of the show itself can't change so dramatically that it feels like something else altogether. And I think that's a challenge. And I think it's incredible that you've scaled to so many cities and built a team while maintaining the vibe of the events as they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, as you've grown and scaled to such a huge number of cities, built a team, is there an experience that you'd be comfortable talking about that you would consider a failure of some sort?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We always have failures, like, all the time. I'll give you a recent failure. So for those that don't know, so, like, R&B Only is our flagship show. And that show is a DJ-based experience where the brand is really what sells the show. So it's very similar to, like, a electronic dance music show with a DJ and a lot of production and a lot of things happening on stage. But there's no artist that really performs. Like, we are pretty much the performers, the DJ and the host. Now, at times, we have guest artists come and surprise the audience. Obviously, we pretty much have the largest live R&B audience in the world. And so there's a lot of R&B artists that we're friends with and people that want to perform on our shows and that type of thing. So a lot of times we have guest performances come up and just like treat various crowds all over the nation. Now, we didn't grow our fan base and build our audience promoting artists or relying on an artist fan base to like come to our shows, right? That was super intentional. What we tried to do with the music festival recently was book artists. So huge celebrities, like we had Queen Naija, another guy named YK Osiris, and another R&B artist named Ashanti. So three major artists in the R&B space, all from different eras and times, recent to a little bit older, so we could get like a larger crowd. And we thought that announcing these artists would actually help us sell more tickets to our show, because now you're adding what we do as R&B only DJs and hosts, and then what these other artists bring to the table with their celebrity. But what ended up happening, quite honestly, was we sold less tickets. We sold less tickets to our festival than we did to shows that are just by ourselves. You know what I mean? We're super data driven. So we actually sent out a survey recently to the people who didn't buy tickets, just kind of trying to get a better gauge and understanding of like what happened there. But one of the assumptions we can come to is that you announce the artist, and it's different from sort of like what we normally do. It gives people the opportunity to say, I don't want to see that artist. I'm okay. I just like going to R&B only. One thing as we do scale our shows and events is like, because we don't just want to do shows for 2,000, 3,000 people all the time. We want to do shows for 5,000 people, 10,000 people. Yeah. And we want to have more things and more types of entertainment there for those people, i.e. food trucks or games or things that are happening outside of the stage. And so we want to do these like indoor, outdoor festivals. And then we also want to bring artists as well to have another experience. But what we realize is that we don't need to announce who these artists are. We can just say, R&B only festival, and here are some surprise guests. Whenever we've had surprise guests in the past, the reaction, like in a live event, the element of surprise is like gold. That's why when you see like confetti pop off or like cryo smoke blow or a balloon drop happen, it's all because people don't know these things are going to happen. And especially when a huge celebrity comes out and performs some hit songs, and people don't know that that's going to happen, the reaction is far better than when you have a show where people know that that person is going to be there, they're expecting it, and then they come out. You can just see it in people's faces. The element of surprise is something that we steered away from in that show and ended up really hurting us, because that show just cost us a lot of money and we lost so much money on it. So, but you know, you live and you learn, but that's an example of understanding, okay, this was an attempt to scale the business in this type of way and it didn't work. And now, you know, you go back to the drawing board, ask your audience what went wrong, and then and attack it in a different manner going forward.
Indeed, you live and learn. And I imagine that's something you're never going to do again. You're going to add surprises.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to lead on surprises going forward. Yeah. And Jabari, you did touch upon how this show is expensive, right? And a lot of your shows are capital intensive. You know, rent out venues, rent out equipment, just fly the DJs. You know, it's capital intensive. And you've written about how you were, like, you wanted to expand and you needed capital. And it was a very, very challenging phase of your life. And I will certainly link a full article in the show notes so people can read the specifics of what happened. I'm curious, though, how did you personally cope with that roller coaster of a time? Because you were apparently also traveling to all these shows and you were trying to do these deals, trying to shore up the money and presumably also looking at the books and the numbers and trying to make everything work. How did you deal with that entire phase?
Yeah, so my history with raising capital was a crazy one. Looking back at it, it was eye-opening, and I'm glad for everything that happened. But I was on the road, and I was going back and forth from show to show, and then I was also talking to, at the time, we had an agent who was helping us with like various shows, and one of the biggest like music agents in the business right now, and I gotta shout him out. He was helping us out a lot, and he is agent for some of the biggest artists in the world. So, like, I don't know if you know Billie Eilish, who's like a huge pop star. He's our agent. Done a lot of stuff with like Diplo, Ed Sheeran, these type of people. That's the agency that we were signed with. And so I said, hey man, I really need some help. And I think, you know, in order for me to scale this thing, I'm really open to raising some money and raising some venture and seeing if I could find a partner that understands how I attack this business. Because I treat my company very similar to how like a tech startup would treat theirs. It's just in a different arena, you know, it's just in a different space. And he said, yeah, these people, they're actually interested in stuff like this. They're making some music investments within like festivals and stuff like that. We gave it a go, but the whole process lasted 5 months, literally like, going back and forth to get to a term sheet. Like just to get to a term sheet probably was a 3 month process.
Yeah.
A lot of meetings, a lot of flying across the country because I'm in LA, they're across the country. So meeting some of their founders and stuff, them coming out here, it was a lot. But ultimately juggling the whole thing, the hardest part about it was how much it took me away from just building and developing my brand. I think that was a time where R&B Only was still on an upward trajectory, but there was a lot of things that I could have been doing in those 5 months.
Yeah.
As far as it relates to just like scaling the business and growing and finding out monetary situation out versus making all these presentations and pitch decks and you're getting the financials in a way that, you know, an investor needs to see them. And I mean, there's a lot of work with my accountant. If it wasn't for that, if it wasn't for me writing about my experience, if it wasn't for that whole experience going down, I think there's a lot of things that that wouldn't have happened because I wasn't vocal about some of the things that were going on in the past in the company. And I think now I'm a little more open to just sharing my experience, because ultimately what I'm trying to do is help other entrepreneurs, help people that look like me and that are in maybe a similar situation, and not just with venture or raising money or stuff like that, but ultimately it was just like, I really want to help people on their journeys within entrepreneurship, marketing, stuff like that. Because I think I've been in this entertainment industry quite a while since I was young. And now I've been able to like amass a little bit of knowledge, and I have no problem with like sharing that information.
Indeed. And it's your openness and honesty, especially, you know, in sharing exactly what happened during those 5 months. I think that can be extremely, very, very inspiring, certainly was to me. Of course, you survived those 5 months. You said no to the money. I think things continue to move forward afterwards for you. What's next for you and R&B Only and Colors? How has sort of not taking that capital impacted your future plans, and how are you thinking about what's coming up next?
Yeah. So number one, that wasn't even the capital that I really needed, right? Like I was trying to raise $1.5 million at the time, right? Now I'm not trying to raise any money at all. Like, because I have to say that I wouldn't raise or I wouldn't take venture, but I feel like I've been able to find other ways to scale the business without that. So one of those ways is having certain events that are lower cost. So we have one event coming up that's sort of like out of our wheelhouse. We used to do it back in the day. Again, that's why I say R&B Only is our flagship event, because we've done many different types of events, right? We've done a comedy show. We've done a 90s event, like a sort of throwback costume event. And even upcoming, we have another show happening in more of the Latin music space. It's kind of the same thing as like R&B Only, but just for a different genre of music and a different, you know, type of music band. So that's what's on the horizon for us, is like scaling the business by doing other types of shows and just broadening our event offering to the public. The main goal within that, though, is to serve these underserved markets and to produce events for people that don't have high quality events for whatever vertical we're talking about. That's one of the things, but also we've been able to use R&B Only as more of a platform and a media outlet. So I recently did a deal with an artist to help her market her tour, and she's a really big R&B artist named Kay Michelle. Basically hired us to help market a regular tour that she's going on. So that tour is kind of like the Kay Michelle tour presented by R&B Only. That's another way that we're getting our feet wet in that world. But because we're really good at selling tickets to an R&B audience, it's like, why not help artists sell tickets to their tours? Eventually, we'll probably start producing other people's tours and being hired to do a lot of other things. Those are just some of the ways that we've been growing and scaling. And then really having this tour that we're on right now, luckily, it's a flying tour, so we don't have to like be on a bus for 2 months and we're away from the office like that. So it's pretty much every weekend for the next 6 to 7 weeks. We have shows all over the place. But I'd say 8 of these dates, we have 2 shows on one day. So that goes back to the scaling model. Yeah. We're able to cover a lot more ground. And that's different from the, like a regular touring artist, right? Like if Jay-Z goes on a tour, he can't do 2 shows in one night.
No.
But luckily, we can. And so I think that's another way that we're able to actually scale and kind of grow quickly, because we can be in multiple places at once. And I think that's a bit of our secret sauce. So those are the things that are on the horizon for us. We definitely want to, 2020 is about R&B Only, as well as our other events, becoming more of like media platforms for these verticals. So we don't want R&B Only to just be a live show. Or we want R&B Only to be the home for all R&B news and original content and that type of thing. So, yeah, that's pretty much what the future is looking like.
Sure. So if one door closed, you were able to open up many more. And that's
absolutely
exciting. That's amazing about you, Jabari. So could you tell us how our listeners can find out more about you?
Yeah, for sure. Well, first, you know, I wanted to thank you for the time. The questions were amazing. I love stuff like this. So you've got a great thing going. They can find R&B Only pretty much on socials. If you go to Instagram, that's probably where we're the most active. Instagram at R&B Only. Colors Worldwide. It's just all Colors Worldwide. My Instagram is at Jabari, J-A-B-A-R-I.
Yeah.
And then Facebook, we're just Colors on there. So cool. Yeah, it's pretty simple. And we're pretty active. YouTube as well. We put a lot of new music on our YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/R&B Only. And we don't really like, websites aren't as important in our space. So we don't really use Colors Worldwide on the website, but we're going to revamp it soon and have some stuff on there.
Very cool. And we're going to link to all of that in the show notes. Jabari, thank you so much. This was an honor. Thank you again for your time.
Oh, thank you very much.
Hey guys, this is Shamant again. Before you go, I have a small but very important favor to ask. If you get any pleasure or inspiration from this episode, could you please leave a review on your favorite podcasting platform, be it iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast fix? This podcast is very much a labor of love. It makes no money, and each episode takes many, many hours to put together. When you leave a rating or write a review, it not only means a great deal of encouragement to me, but it also supports getting the word out about How Things Grow. Thank you again for listening, and I look forward to seeing you with the next episode. Thank you.